And my father decided to take the two of us out for a walk on a hot July day, and we sat in a park. In fact, we lay down on the ground, and my father picked up a piece of clover. Thank you very much. Picked up a piece of clover, and he literally started talking about the birds and the bees. And there was a sense inside of me as a six-year-old that I kind of knew that this conversation was going to be different than any other conversation that I'd had, even though I didn't really understand the content. And then we started going into the whole mechanics of where babies come from. And I can remember the way that my father's tone in the telling was very soft and very gentle, and I know that my eyes were wide open, as were my brother's. When I think of it now, he also started to talk about wet dreams, masturbation, and he talked about you need to be really careful that some adults can hurt you. That was 1968. I'd like to think that my father, my parents were a little ahead of the curve, talking about pleasure and mechanics, but also about being very careful. I can remember going back into the home where we were staying with a bit of a lift in my step, and I remember my mother saying, "And how are you boys?" And I can remember at the time going, "Just fine," feeling as though I had grown up just a little bit. It was enough of a talk, when I think of it now, at age six, to equip me for about 15 minutes. Because when you think about, for most of us, that conversation began when we were entering adolescence and our bodies were changing and our understanding and reality of the world was beginning to change. And we didn't really understand ourselves from the inside, and we were formed just as much from the outside what other people were saying. And often when we talked about sexuality, it was derogatory terms and accusatory terms, especially in the locker room. Or the muffled tones that were spoken of at the back of the class. And some of us were better equipped in those days than others because we had some folks in our lives who were willing and able to talk about it. When I think about my own journey, I wished at some point somebody could have taken me aside and said, "This is what it's like in your 20s, in your 30s, in your 40s, in your 50s and beyond." Fast forward to when I'm about 18 years old, and I happen to be at home with my grandmother. My grandfather had died just a few years before. And my grandmother and I were chatting about relationships and love. And somehow we got onto the topic of sex. And then she looked at me and she said, "You know, your grandfather and I, we loved sex. We had sex all the time." And I just kept going, "Oh my God." It was just a little bit too much for an 18-year-old boy. And now, however, at age 56, I'm going, "Way to go." Like, on the other hand, because I was hearing from a senior and a matriarch in our family that this is okay. That this is actually something to be celebrated. So wherever your experience is on your own journey and the people who have taught you and told you, we are formed by those experiences. It's also really important to be reminded that some of us experienced trauma when we were children. And it was sexual trauma at the hands of somebody else who took advantage of us. And that we need to be able to be very careful in the way that we talk about sexuality in our own history. Because for some of us, that was a very difficult beginning. And so it's very helpful, and I think, to remind ourselves that when we talk about sexuality, we're always walking on holy ground. Whether we start in a holistic and wonderful, mysterious way, or whether or not that beginning was very difficult and traumatic. And who we are as sexual beings when we were six, and who we are now, is very different. We can see inklings of when we were young, but there's also a sense that on that journey, we have changed along the way. When you think about the experience of what was happening on the outside, and Masters and the work of Masters and Johnson and of Alfred Kinsey and Wardell Pomeroy and other sociologists and psychologists who have helped kind of bring us to a new base of understanding, the Kinsey sliding scale that gives us kind of an understanding of where we are and our own identity and gender identity and sexual orientation, that a lot of that work since the 1950s has been groundbreaking. And where we think we are now as we understand different modalities and where we are in terms of our own experience, gender binary, male, female, straight, and or gay is not sort of a black and white experience. That we now have terms in our common parlance of genderqueer, gender fluid, neutroy, agender, two-spirit, hijra, and transgendered. All pieces of insight that have come to us from the outside and from the inside as a journey, as a people. I'm trying to think how my father might sit down in the grass in PEI and explain how our own conversation around gender identity and sexuality might sound different now. And when I think of from 1968 to 2017, the way that we have come to understand ourselves as sexual beings, made in God's image, it is a powerful thing for us to contemplate as Anglican Christians. While the world has spent much of its time exploring and trying to understand us as sexual beings, often the church has been quiet. Or we get very rigid and we keep ourselves in a box and we say it's this and it's this. This is good, this is not good. Some of us grew up in churches where the conversation was very fluid and open. But many of us grew up in churches where that conversation was really never allowed to happen. We never heard about sexuality from the pulpit. There were nuances around it, but we made our own decisions and our own connections based on what was happening on the inside and the assumptions of what was happening on the outside. So I stand in front of you this evening, not as a Masters and Johnson's expert. I had Psychology 101, like the rest of you in university. But I come tonight to talk from my experience as a parish priest of almost 30 years, of serving in parishes in Guelph, in a small town of Acton, in the suburbs of Oakville, in downtown. And as a parish priest who has walked with many, many, many people of all ages, young and very elderly, who tell me things. It's one of the great privileges as an Anglican cleric that people open up and they tell the most intimate pieces of their own journey, both the trauma and the delight. And often the conversation moves towards sexuality and spirituality together. I'm not going to tell their stories because that's not my story. What I would like to do is talk a little bit about how is it that we have now arrived in 2017 from 1968, some of us earlier than that, and to see how we as Christians talk about wending sexuality with spirituality together, not from a psychological perspective necessarily, not from a biological perspective necessarily, not from a scientific background necessarily, but really about we as a people of God who have a story set in biblical scriptures and as a liturgical people who find themselves now in the 21st century. And how do we as Christians talk about this sacred gift that God has given to us, not as a shame, but as a gift. That sound like a good place to start? When we think about some religious traditions like tantric sex, Kama Sutra, Hindu writings that speak very much with delight around sexuality. We tend to see in other traditions an opportunity to explore our own. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those pieces in Scripture that talk about delight. But I'd also like to talk a little bit about Scripture and how we read it together, because how we read it makes a big difference. So when you're reading a piece of Scripture, we tend to begin actually with our own experience. Just like we learn something about our own sexual orientation and gender identity, we learn it from our first from ourselves and how we are formed on the outside. We tend to look at the Bible from two traditional lenses. One is from a conservative ethic or a liberal ethic. And I'm going to touch a little bit tonight on the long conversations that Anglicans have been having in the last 20 years around our walk with gay and lesbian members in the community, because it's the most recent conversation that we've had. In my whole 30-year career, my conversation around gay and lesbian sexuality, marriage, same-sex blessings has been absolutely front and center. And a lot of Anglicans have tried to avoid it, and a lot of Anglicans have tried to minimize Scripture and say, let's not deal with that. Others have said it's perfectly natural. Others have said it's not. And listening to Anglicans talk about gay and lesbian men and women who are members, especially in our community, as sacred members, is often actually not been a very helpful conversation along the way. It's been difficult. But in all of those conversations, what I also hear ringing out is our own ability to talk about sex or not talk about it, and also to wend it to our own biblical story. So I've found the moniker of a conservative and liberal not particularly helpful, because there are some things that I'm very conservative about, and there are other things that I'm very liberal about. And there's some things that I was very liberal about, now I'm conservative, and I find myself switching back and forth. If we are honest with ourselves, we actually hold both ends together. Jacob Milgram, who is an Old Testament theologian, likes to use the term maximalist and a minimalist. Let me just explain what those two mean, because it'll form kind of the basis of how we talk about Scripture tonight. Maximalist or the minimalist. So he uses this as an adage. He says, imagine, he says, looking down at the American Constitution. The Constitution was a document that articulated the founding principles of the United States of America. It was both a document that spoke of a generation of leaders articulating a present reality, of naming a place from where they were coming from, but fundamentally a document that would form the guiding principles of an emerging country. As the society would change and grow over 200 years, the laws needed to address the realities of a changing society that would need somehow to comport to the Constitution. This was left to the courts and the judges to pore over the weight of the law and the places of contradiction to ensure that it needed to conform. And yet how a judge approaches that particular text makes all the difference in the world. The minimalist approaches the Constitution by looking for the core values that underlie the document, looking at the broad directives of the document that would inform the furthering of a new direction. The minimalist asks two questions. The first, extrapolate the guiding principles behind the words of the Bible. How do I take the words that are in front of me and use them for the future? Then they ask themselves the question, if the composers of the Constitution or the Bible were living today, how would they apply these principles? So the minimalist basically looks at the body of the work and says, how are these values going to guide us into the future? On the other hand, the maximalist takes every word that was written down and does all the hard research of the writers who wrote those words down to see how those words were used in other texts that the author might have used to make sure that they were using the words in accordance with the original meaning. So the maximalist tends to be much more literal in their approach. The minimalist looks at the big picture and the values, and the maximalist says, we're going for the absolute detail to make sure that every word in this text makes sense. So the maximalist would say of a text from Leviticus, these are words that were handed down on Mount Sinai, and every word needs to be absolutely sure. The minimalist might say, it's really not clear whether all of these words actually came down from Mount Sinai. What is the intent of these words as we listen to them as a congregation? So when we say, love your neighbor as yourself, we might actually be all on the same page, except the minimalist and the maximalist might actually interpret that meaning differently. They may take it literally, depending on who your neighbor is. Inevitably, there are contradictions, and there are moments of disconnect. And those are the moments where the maximalist and the minimalist, people who dwell in the pews, all come together and say, how do we actually understand how to interpret what's happening for us now? So there's the old Midrashic tale that says that Moses said to the master of the universe, will it always be clear how the law is to be interpreted? And the master of the universe says, not always. And Moses said, then how will I know which direction to go? And the master says, the majority. When the majority say that it's pure, it's pure. When the majority say it's impure, it's impure. Our tradition as Christians and as a biblical people is actually built on the idea of revelation. We are always waiting for the revelation to come from within and from without. So when we approach a biblical text and we say that the world has changed since 1968, how do I take all of the learnings from Masters and Johnsons and the experience of my own and my children and my grandchildren, and I wed it to the text of the Bible, and I what was once impure, when does it become pure? That sound familiar?